All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Siobhan Sarna and very happy to have you here. We're going to be talking about mitochondria today. Kara Seidman is here, and she is with Microbiome Labs, but she's also a registered dietitian and expert unto herself. And this is her jam. And I'm in a very weird location right now. I'm actually in my bathroom with my cat because I have people working at the house, and the cat was freaking out. And so I thought, well, I'm gonna go spend time with my cat. No one needs to see the bathroom, so I blurred the background. It's anyway, I really appreciate you all being here. Clarissa's in the background if you have any tech issues. And if you have any questions, please put it in the Q&A. And remember, the one rule is be nice or be gone. And please refrain from chatting during the session unless it's a tech issue. We do have a 15% coupon for you for Microbiome Labs, which is hot, very hard to come by.
Oh, yeah.
And as I've been saying, that I have no idea how much longer that's going to last, but I'm going to keep saying it because it's true. And I can't, I just hope it never ends. But it's been a great run, so let's just keep the good vibes going. Mitochondria. We don't really think about it. I think we take it for granted. And I think once we understand a little bit more about it and its relationship with the microbiome, we're going to have more energy. We're going to make different subtle, perhaps, changes. And I'm excited for this because it's a whole new discussion. And I'm really glad you're here. So thank you very much. And
Thank
tell us a little
you.
about yourself.
Well, thank you again so much for having us on. We love talking about, all things related to health. And I think this is a really fun topic. I think mitochondria is really hot in the news. But yeah, you said I'm a registered dietitian. I've been with Microbiome Labs coming up to almost a year now. Prior to that, I worked for almost 9 years in a gastroenterology practice. I started a functional nutrition program for them and spent a long time. I'm here in beautiful Denver, Colorado. And just love this shift. I love educating. So I'm excited to be here. And hopefully, everyone walks away with some clinical pearls that they can start applying and start thinking about their lives and their health a little differently.
Oh, perfection. We are
Yeah.
going to the replay out tonight. And Ida, thank you so much that you volunteered to take Petunia with you. I appreciate that. And hi, Dr. Lux. Good to have you. And Susanna, it's great to have you all here. Thank you very much. We're going to get started. So go ahead and share your screen, and
Perfect.
I will hide my camera. Thanks.
Okay, let me get the slideshow going. I can never move this away when it's there. And okay, from the beginning. All right, is everyone just seeing my slides? Yeah, good. Okay. I am going to just turn my camera off just so you guys can look at the slides. You're not distracted by my many faces. Okay, so I'm really excited to talk about this and maybe a different angle on mitochondrial health. Again, this is really in the news a lot when we talk about everything from aging to energy and all of the above. So mitochondrial function is, it's truly at the basis of the structure and function of our entire human body. It's important to power growth. It's important for healing and the processes that are all necessary to adapt to the changing external environment. And optimal mitochondrial function is essential for health. And there's such a growing body of research now showing that dysfunction is surprisingly common and it's associated with most chronic conditions. So let's get a little bit of the 101 out of the way for those of us, right? We often think of our mitochondria as the powerhouse of the cell. These are dynamic and hardworking organelles, right? They're found inside almost every human body. And we know that the primary function of our mitochondria is to generate ATP. This is our energy currency of the body. And this ATP is essential for cells to carry out all of their necessary functions. And because we think of the mitochondria as that metabolic hub, or some people call it the battery of the cell. I like to think of it as the engine to our car, right? It has so many roles beyond ATP, which we'll talk about today. And all of the functions that our mitochondria perform are really dependent upon both the integrity of each mitochondria, as well as the individual mitochondria, but also the integrity of the entire mitochondrial network. And interestingly enough, so that everyone knows, A healthy person at rest will produce their body weight in ATP, and our cells can actually contain anywhere from 1,000 to 2,500 mitochondria. So these are hardworking, you know, organelles, but they're constantly working. So we've evolved our thinking when it comes to mitochondria that they are really beyond just the powerhouse of the cell, and that they play a significant role in many different aspects related to overall health and well-being. And all the different ways that mitochondria support our overall health, we also have to show that same support to our mitochondria. Otherwise, we start to see dysfunction, and that drives a lot of the conditions we see today. So beyond the powerhouse, these are just a short list of everything that our mitochondria is related to. Apoptosis, for those of you that don't know, that's that programmed cell death. And without it, we can essentially end up with what's known as immortal cells, or what's known as cancer cells. We're going to talk a lot about redox state today. And this is important because an optimal redox state is essential to maintain mitochondrial health. It's important in preventing the generation of what's known as reactive oxygen species, that these ultimately lead to what's known as oxidative stress. And this is essentially what drives damage and dysfunction to different mitochondrial components. Reactive oxygen species balance. So we know that throughout the process of making ATP, that this is a process that actually creates reactive oxygen species. Reactive oxygen species are, I'm going to say ROS because it's a mouthful, but these are a waste product. They essentially need to be quenched because they can be toxic to the cells. They can interfere with many processes like DNA and glycoproteins. And the production of ROSs are really a major focus for so much of the research now. Mitochondria play a role in detoxification, the aging process. So we talk a lot about longevity and lifespan. I like to think of it as health span, because we can live longer, but we're not necessarily living healthier. And at the root of that is the health of our mitochondria, as well as the microbiome health. So just to understand a little bit of energy, right? So human energy production relies on our mitochondria. And this is a process known as cellular respiration. This is a process by which food in the form of sugar, what we call glucose, right, our primary source of fuel, is transformed into energy within the cells. And this energy is stored in ATP molecules, right, our energy currency, which then is necessary to power all sorts of cellular processes, those of which we just discussed in those previous slides. And we know that glucose goes through lots of different stages to produce ATP. So first we have an aerobic respiration. This needs oxygen to produce really massive amounts of ATP. So we have the first process, which is glycolysis. This ends in two substrates, what's known as pyruvate and NADH. NADH is an electron carrier. So part of this cellular respiration is this what's known as the electron transport chain. I always want to say train. Electron transport chain, ETC. And so this actually occurs in the mitochondria, where pyruvate is used to create what's known as acetyl-CoA. We also create carbon dioxide. And then these go through what's known as the Krebs cycle, or the citric acid cycle, where we create, this is where we start to create ATP. We create another electron carrier substrate, and then they finally go through the final process with oxygen, and the end result is lots and lots of ATP. So this is a preferred process to generate the most ATP in the body. But we also have another process known as anaerobic respiration, which we are going to talk a little bit more about this. So in anaerobic respiration, there's no oxygen present. And so why isn't there any oxygen? Well, maybe it's because at the time, there's been certain oxygen deprivation, or in certain types of cells that don't rely on oxygen. Oh, are you not in full screen? Let me stop my share. Let me see about this. Okay, let's share my screen again.
You got it?
Leah, let me go back to, what was it showing?
Let's see, try it again.
Yeah, let me try this again. Oh, it was showing the notes. It shouldn't choose that. You guys are reading my script.
We were doing a great job.
You know, we got to have notes sometimes. Okay, let me share this again.
Thanks, Lee.
What are we seeing now?
I see your notes.
Okay, let me go through. Okay, what are we seeing now?
Yeah, I see it with your notes. Does anyone have a tip for her about going to maybe, isn't it like presenter mode? There you go. You got it. Now
All
it's
right.
Ready. She'll present. Now, there you go.
Now what do you see?
I see no notes, even though you're a genius. We all have notes.
And you know, sometimes we do. It's one of those days.
It's all good. It's all good. And now we see it full screen, your slide about how is energy made. And there
perfect.
You're on it.
Now
Sorry
you guys
to catch that
have now you guys
guys.
Have all learned our secrets of how we do these webinars, right?
We like transparency, so it's all good. All right.
Oh yeah, totally. Okay, so back to it, where we are talking about that anaerobic respiration. And so anaerobic respiration, again, sometimes we have energy deprivation. There's deprivation in our muscles, maybe certain cells that don't actually require oxygen for production. So this actually allows our cells to continue to produce ATP, right? So that if we don't, then we have zero energy whatsoever. So ATP is essentially created through other processes. But the end product of this type of respiration is actually a much, much, much lower amount of ATP. And this is problematic because low levels of ATP, right, our energy currency, can lead to changes in how we feel, right? This can impact day-to-day functioning. This can lead to us having a weakened metabolism or feeling slow and sluggish. So more ATP and that generation of more ATP allows us to experience, you know, life with, you know, more vitality and more energy. Okay. So there are lots and lots of different threats that can occur to our mitochondria. And these are things that I like to think of as mitochondrial disruptors. These are essentially, you know, common things that we're exposed to in our day-to-day life. And certain lifestyle factors can impair the integrity and the function of our mitochondria. Things like antibiotics, certain medications. Statins, this is one that, you know, is very common understanding that, you know, these are widely prescribed medications for hyperlipidemia, high blood cholesterol, and they actually deplete certain coenzymes like CoQ10, which is so important when it comes to mitochondrial health. We see, you know, high blood sugar, so diabetes and sleep disturbances. So lots of these common things that many of us face in our day-to-day life, even disruptions in the microbiome. So if we think about that last slide, if we think about how many of these threats or, you know, what we call these mitochondrial disruptors we're exposed to in our daily life, a good question we want to ask, you know, one that so much of the research is actually focused on, is this question of, is our mitochondria stressed? And I think this is a great question because it's not always something like we talked about early on that we think about or we contribute to a lot of our health issues. So we're essentially wanting to know if our mitochondria are in spaghetti mode or in this meatball mode. So when our mitochondria are happy, when they're healthy, they're in what's known as this spaghetti mode. They're living in a colony, they're interacting as a community. They're working together to improve oxidation, to improve cellular respiration, to increase that ATP production. But when they're in this meatball mode, they're all balled up. They retreat. They don't want to work together as a community. So I'm just going to review a few of these terms you see here because they're going to come up again throughout our presentation. So fusion, this is that spaghetti mode. This is what happens when, let me get to that laser pointer. This is what happens when our mitochondria form that network. They're more metabolically active. This fission mode here is when our mitochondria are more fragmented. They look more like a meatball mode. And our mitochondria are constantly undergoing continuous cycles of this fusion and fission. But excessive fission has actually been associated with mitochondrial dysfunction. And this is shown to lead to many, many diseases and chronic conditions. Now, fusion and fission and what's known as mitophagy, this is where we remove dysfunctional mitochondria. These are, you know, part of normal mitochondria, are really necessary when it comes to any type of normal mitochondrial function. But they're also associated with what's known as mitochondrial biogenesis. This is the creation of new mitochondria in a cell. So, for example, when mitochondrial fission, that meatball mode, becomes increasingly dominant or more prevalent, the damaged mitochondria start to undergo this mitophagy, the removal of dysfunctional mitochondria. And this could ultimately cause our mitochondria to fail to produce sufficient amounts of ATP. So we're failing then to produce or perform all those necessary functions that we already talked about. And this is because mitophagy results in the accumulation of those reactive oxygen species, and that starts to damage the mitochondria even further. So this is what leads to ultimately oxidative stress. So to review, and really what's happening, there's three primary issues that occur when it comes to our mitochondria being stressed. So what's known as low biogenesis, so low creation of new mitochondria, low mitophagy, the removal of dysfunctional mitochondria, and then what's known as this redox imbalance. So low biogenesis in the mitochondria creates low ATP production, and that lower energy production within the cell means that the cell is just not as efficient as it should be. And when it's not as efficient, this will ultimately lead to what's known as redox imbalance. Now, low mitophagy, this leads to a higher amount of those reactive oxygen species. This also leads to the accumulation of defects that can occur to the cell itself. This can ultimately lead to more tumorigenic cells. And then low levels of ATP occur because you just aren't clearing out those damaged cells, right? We want to clear away things that are damaged in the body. And we see this a lot even in the inflammatory, you know, model. But we're not clearing out the damaged cells and replacing them, or the damaged mitochondria, and replacing them with good mitochondria. So we essentially get this loss of apoptosis and that programmed cell death. And this can lead to what's known as those immortal cells. And then redox imbalance, because you have cellular and DNA damage that's occurred because of this greater reactive oxygen species production, this low ATP, this is generally creating more oxidative stress in the body, more stress than you have in energy production. So there's an imbalance in that balance. You just don't have enough ATP to counteract that. And that leads to a loss again of apoptosis, a loss of healthy cells, which are just so necessary for tissue function. And so all of this essentially leads to fatigue, tissue degeneration, you know, overgrowth of certain types of cells. We're not going to talk about it too much today, but this is why when we look at cancer and the development of cancer, mitochondria really are at the root of that and at the foundation of that. And when there's these defects, we ultimately see effects and disruptions to virtually all aspects of our health, from our neurons and the development of neurodegenerative diseases, which we'll talk about later. Our immune cells, you know, each cell has its own mitochondria. So lots of oxidative stress is going to impact our overall health and contribute to a lot of the conditions we're seeing today. All of our cells require energy, and therefore all require good, healthy mitochondrial function. And all these effects that we're seeing that virtually affect every aspect of the body can occur and ultimately contribute to probably one of the most common consequences or symptoms that we see with mitochondrial dysfunction, and this is fatigue. Fatigue is really most often ranked as one of the most frustrating symptoms, not just for the patients themselves, but also the provider. It's a hard condition to treat because it really impacts and is so disruptive to our day-to-day living. So fatigue is considered a multidimensional sensation. It's not just that loss of overall energy and the ability, but also the inability to perform even simple tasks without exertion. So I call it both mental and physical fatigue, because sometimes we think of fatigue as I'm just so tired, or but also brain fog, and our brain's just not working as efficiently. So mild fatigue we know can be caused by a number of conditions. We know depression and lots of other conditions contribute, but much of our moderate to severe fatigue that we see involves our cellular energy systems, our mitochondria, and essentially that loss or reduction in ATP production. So remember, that loss of ATP production within each cell leads to the cell just not being as efficient as it should be. And when not efficient, this leads to that redox imbalance. And we'll talk more about that as we move on. Now, intractable fatigue, or fatigue that's lasting more than 6 months, that's not reversed by sleep or other interventions, this is what's known as chronic fatigue. And this is most common complaint. And this is really one of the number one reasons why patients actually seek general medical care, not just functionally speaking, but also from general medical providers. It's a secondary condition that we see with so many other clinical diagnoses, like autoimmune conditions and heart conditions and GI issues, right? And this is why, because mitochondria are in every cell of the body. So people with chronic fatigue syndrome, what we ultimately think is related to mitochondrial dysfunction is really because we see this level of oxidative stress or oxidative damage to our DNA as well as our lipids. And this is being presented through certain blood markers, oxidized blood markers. Lots of functional providers and practitioners will do oxidative stress tests to measure certain levels of these markers. But we also see these individuals having higher and sustained levels of something known as peroxynitrite. And this is caused by having excessive nitric acid or nitric oxide in the body. And this leads to a process known as lipid peroxidation, which is where our free radicals ultimately create damage to our cell membranes. And this leads to dysfunction within the cell and ultimately loss of that mitochondrial function. So as we continue to see these statistics of, you know, fatigue statistics on the rise, it's, again, a very difficult symptom that we have people complaining about. It's one of the number one symptoms that people come and seek help for. We really have to consider the health of our mitochondria as a primary driver. Again, we're not creating energy within. We aren't going to feel energized as we face the external world. So how do we start to bring support to the mitochondria? Mitochondrial integrity is essential, and there are many different nutrients and different lifestyle factors that can not only reduce the oxidative burden of ATP generation, but it can provide additional substrates for when we have oxidative stress. We know some of these nutrients can help repair leaky membranes within the mitochondria. This essentially will help improve that electron transport system. And there's nutrients that can even support that mitochondrial biogenesis, which is that generation of new mitochondria. So just to go through a few of these right now, so CoQ10, we already mentioned that with when we talked about statins, but this is a potent antioxidant. We know this helps to reduce reactive oxygen species production. It's a cofactor in the electron transport chain. We know it targets mitochondrial biogenesis. And again, certain medications like our statins, which are so widely prescribed, contribute to CoQ10 depletion. Alpha-lipoic acid is another great antioxidant. It's a cofactor in mitochondrial energy production. NAC, especially with magnesium, we know this helps to optimize mitochondrial function. It's used in ATP production. We also know this helps to increase glutathione levels in the body. Vitamin E, vitamin C are both very great antioxidants. Vitamin E can help to protect the cell membranes from lipid oxidation. We know that vitamin C can help preserve mitochondrial membrane potential. So lots of great options there. B vitamins, of course, are important because they're required as cofactors for enzymes in cellular function and energy production. Now, I have a note here of no cyanocobalamin. We'll talk about, you know, better options, but our methylated Bs are a great option because when we looked at that slide related to the threats to mitochondrial, cyanide, which is a very low amount in our B12, our non-methylated B12, could actually be a little bit more damaging to the mitochondria. Our omega-3 fatty acids are really important. We know this helps to, again, support mitochondrial membrane restoration. And then our big focus for today is going to be on the role of vitamin K2. This is where we're going to spend the rest of our time because the research surrounding vitamin K2 is really new. And actually, this is a sort of newer function of vitamin K2 that they're looking at as far as its role in mitochondrial function. So much of the research is around bone and heart health, but we've got these new functions, which makes it even more exciting. And that's why there's been such an increase in this body of research. So let's review our K vitamins. Vitamin K, this is a collective term for our fat-soluble vitamins or fat-soluble compounds. Vitamin K1 is known as phylloquinones, and vitamin K2 is known as menaquinones. And these actually, even though they're part of the same family, they have very, very, very little in common. So it's like, you know, being like a twin and you have nothing in common, right? You're part of that same family, but you don't share much else. And maybe that's not a good example because twins share a lot. But they have very little in common, not only in their food sources that differ, but their functions are drastically different. So vitamin K1, which we can see here, and then we have two different forms of vitamin K2, which we'll talk about. But vitamin K1 is typically found in your green leafy vegetables, spinach and lettuce, your kales, your bok choy. And then vitamin K2 is primarily found in our fermented foods. So thinking about fermented cheeses, but the most densely concentrated K2 food is natto. And you guys can all chime in the chat. I don't know if anyone's ever tried natto before. It's a Japanese superfood. It's very, very high in K2. But it is an acquired taste. It's definitely not something, and I love fermented foods, but it has got a very pungent taste to it. So this is where we also have to look to supplementation, but we also create vitamin K2 through bacterial fermentation, which we'll talk about. Lots of healthy gut bacteria can produce vitamin K2. Now, their functions are very, very different. So K1 primarily plays a role in blood coagulation. And this is via activating certain processes in the liver, whereas vitamin K2 actually works in our bloodstream, and it plays a key role in multiple health functions. In fact, the research is extremely far-reaching. And as things stand, they've discovered that we have around 18 vitamin K-dependent proteins that our bodies produce that are dependent on vitamin K activating, which we'll talk about a few of those in a moment. Now, studies have shown that this K27, vitamin K27, has better bioavailability than other forms of vitamin K2, and that it's meaning that it's absorbed more easily in the body. It also has a longer half-life than our K24, our MK4. And so this just results in a more stable product to help stabilize our blood levels and our concentration of K2 in the body. Now, in terms of supplementation, because I know that, you know, a lot of us here, whether we're practitioners and we look to supplements, but because K2 is just not readily found in the diet, supplementation is often necessary. And we're going to talk a lot about that throughout this presentation today. But what's interesting about MK4 is that because the number one, because the half-life is so short, you have to take sort of constant intake of it to maintain your serum levels. And so because of this longer half-life, again, you're going to get a much, much longer sustained level of it. But the other important clinical pearl that I always like to talk about, especially when we're looking at supplements, a lot of us don't ever look at which type of K2 is added to supplements, but the MK7 form, this form here, what we call in organic chemistry, for those of you who've had to take it, I never can forget the horror of organic chemistry, but this is what's known as the trans form. It's created through natural fermentation, whereas supplements that have this MK4, this is synthetically made, and this potentially poses a problem because they haven't been studied for their long-term effects, and they also can potentially contain traces of harmful solvents. And in the case of mitochondrial health, these can potentially be more damaging or more disruptive to our mitochondria. So what is vitamin K's role? What makes vitamin K2 so special and so important? Well, it's necessary because when we look at certain vitamin K-dependent proteins, vitamin K2 does what's known as carboxylation. This is the activation of turning these inactive proteins into active proteins. And this is important because these active proteins are involved in so many health-related issues, and only vitamin K2 can actually activate these issues. Or activate these proteins. So the largest body of research is actually surrounding these two proteins here, matrix GLA protein and osteocalcin. And these play a huge role in heart disease and osteoporosis, two of our leading causes of both morbidity and mortality, not just here in the United States, but also globally. And these vitamin K2, because of that activation, these proteins are necessary because they actually can help calcium get to where it needs to go. So we like to think of, you know, K2 as that Uber driver, that shuttle to drive calcium to where it needs to go. So it takes calcium away from the arteries and deposits it into the bones where we want it. Because if calcium stays in our arteries, then this leads to things like atherosclerosis and calcification. And if it doesn't get into the bones, then it can contribute to the development of osteoporosis. So this is important because not only do we have these proteins that are dependent on vitamin K2, but through the research and what we found is that deficiency in vitamin K2 is widespread, not just in adults, but children as well. And this really has prompted the surge in research surrounding vitamin K2 and how, you know, we've now discovered that so many clinical conditions and so many issues are related to K2 deficiency beyond that of heart and bone. And I actually find it quite interesting because if you think about heart disease and osteoporosis, again, those two leading causes, with all the advancements that we've had in medicine and therapies, we still continue to see the rate of these conditions on the rise. And so it's really prompted the research to say, what else? What are we missing? And K2 has really been that sort of missing link that we've been looking for. So what are causes or reasons we see widespread K2 deficiency? Well, potentially related to poor diet quality, right? We just don't get sufficient amounts of K2, processed foods, over-prescription of calcium. This has been in the news a lot and a lot of research, at essentially flooding the arterial walls, overstimulating the binding capacity. We need K2 to drive calcium to where it needs to go. We also see the increase of calcium or vitamin D prescription and really high doses of vitamin D without K2. And this will actually stimulate osteoblasts, so types of cells to help with bone formation. But this will actually pull more K2 from the body and actually contribute to depleting our bodily stores of K2. Dysbiosis, right? Depletion of beneficial bacteria, because we get K2 through bacterial fermentation. And then again, those statin drugs. So statins in the news in the lot, because these can actually inhibit K2 synthesis, which is going to impair that activation of those essential proteins, like matrix GLA protein. So what about K2 specifically with mitochondrial health? So K2 transfers electrons from those complex 1 and 2 to complex 3. And this is really necessary in that production of ATP. So they found that defects in the mitochondria were actually alleviated by supplementing with K2, and this actually boosted that ETC, or that electron transport chain activity. So this has implications with mitochondrial related diseases, aging, as well as even athletes. So when we look at this function, right, this redox, our mitochondria, as we discussed, they carry out cellular respiration. This involves those redox reactions. So essentially we need this to remove electrons from those carbon atoms, right? This is cellular respiration again. And this process plays a role in nerve health, in muscle health and muscle contraction, as well as cardiac function and output. So let's look at neuropathy. So went a little crazy there. So neuropathy, various types of neuropathy. We know peripheral neuropathy is the most widely diagnosed type of neuropathy. And this can be due to diabetes. We know this contributes to a large amount of peripheral neuropathy, but so is B12 deficiency, which can cause something called megaloblastic anemia. Oh my goodness, my clicker. Okay. So diabetes and peripheral neuropathy, I think this is interesting to make note of, because we see a large percentage of people with diabetes developing peripheral neuropathy. And one point that I want to make is here, metformin that's used to treat diabetes can actually worsen peripheral neuropathy, because it can actually deplete the body of our B12 stores. But there's actually, interestingly, been a lot of studies done on metformin and metformin's role in mitochondrial function, and that it may actually be helpful for mitochondrial function, and that it can improve cellular respiration and repairing damage that can occur within the Krebs cycle. It can alleviate the effects of reactive oxygen species. So on one hand, you have a drug that could be potentially causing, you know, worse symptoms, but can actually be helping mitochondrial dysfunction. So when we look at that, and we looked at that sort of dichotomy, we have to think, okay, well, what's the missing link? How do we prevent those symptoms, but also still support mitochondrial health? And that's where vitamin K2 comes into play. So this was a really large study that looked at 38,000 men and women aged 20 to 70. And they found that participants who consumed the most dietary vitamin K2 were 20% less likely to develop type 2 diabetes. And they found in this study that the higher intake of K2 was actually linked to lower diabetes risk. And I'm just going to highlight varying amounts of K2, because we're going to talk about this when we get to the end of our webinar. But this study used upwards to about 360 micrograms per day. So vitamin K2 actually can reduce the progression of insulin resistance. And it was also found to potentially improve insulin sensitivity. And this is through activating that osteocalcin, which is a very important hormone that increases insulin sensitivity. So just to review this slide again, vitamin K2 activates osteocalcin. Osteocalcin can actually promote the proliferation or the production of our pancreatic beta cells, which we know are important in insulin. These are what secrete insulin. But it also influences insulin sensitivity, the adiponectin. This is a hormone that's produced by our adipose tissue, and this regulates various metabolic processes in the body, and higher levels are actually associated with improved insulin sensitivity. So how does it do this? What's the mechanism behind? Well, vitamin K2 has actually been shown to inhibit something known as NF-kappa-B. This is a protein complex that's on all of our immune cells, so our macrophages and our dendritic cells. And this plays a crucial role in regulating the expression of pro-inflammatory cytokines. So it's like the master switch that just turns on inflammation. And so by suppressing this, we can actually improve insulin resistance because we suppress those inflammatory mechanisms. This was a study looking at K2 and alleviating symptoms related to peripheral neuropathy. And this was 200 micrograms that were provided. And they used this by something known as the visual analog scale. And just for purposes of this study to go over, a score of greater than 4 is consistent with peripheral neuropathy. So we can see at baseline, the scores were quite high. And just after 4 weeks, we see the VAS reducing. By 8 weeks, reducing to a point where, you know, in some people, it wasn't even diagnosed. And by the end of the 12 weeks, the symptoms, the tingling, all the weakness, had actually improved drastically, and the intensity of cramps were actually so much better. And so you can see that weren't even consistent with diagnosis. So pretty cool. And no other changes, just vitamin K2. So again, what's happening in the realm of peripheral neuropathy? Well, there's another vitamin K-dependent protein. And we know that vitamin K2, from looking at its role in neuroinflammation, can facilitate the synthesis and the repair of the myelin sheath in the peripheral nervous system. So that, again, we're inhibiting that master switch, that inflammatory master switch that just gets turned on. And so it's by suppressing that, we start to suppress inflammation. So real quick, this was just a study that was looking at those terms again that we talked about before: fusion, fission, mitophagy, biogenesis. And these are all part of what's known as that mitochondrial quality loop. And this study was specifically looking at a specific nerve agent, 6-OHDA, and they found that this nerve agent can actually cause mitochondrial damage, and that an imbalance in these processes, this fusion and fission, impacts mitophagy and biogenesis. And essentially what they found in this study was that vitamin K2 can actually inhibit this nerve cell and actually improve the function of our mitochondria. And this is really important when it comes to neurodegenerative conditions like Parkinson's, and may actually explain some of the neuroinflammation that we see related to Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
I just wanted to pause for a second to go, wow, out loud, because you're dropping some incredible information, from the blood sugar and the glucose and the insulin to Parkinson's. Like, we think of vitamin D and K2
right,
as like nice, you know,
right? Yeah,
like good to know, but this is huge. This is
it
absolutely
is.
Huge. We have about 15 minutes left. I know you're almost done, but because this is so powerful, you're going to talk about the products from Microbiome Labs,
yep,
that also support this. And I wanted Clarissa, just to sort of speed ahead, to put the link for the 15% discount and the code for anything at Microbiome Labs, including the stool test, the vaginal microbiome, yes, test. So I just wanted to get that going, because
perfect,
I don't want to like wait until the end and then people are squeezing to get
totally
the link. Okay, carry on, you're doing great.
I promise I'm almost done.
Well, it's also gorgeous. I don't want to rush you, but like, wow.
So just looking a little bit at muscle health, because we talked again, that's another function. So again, this was just a study. Now I want to say that this was 100 micrograms a day looking at muscle cramps, and muscle cramps are something that impacts many of us and can, you know, I know my father is someone who suffers from muscle cramps, you know, almost every day. And so they had two groups. And again, using that same score, they had a group that had cramps daily, as well as a group that had 2 to 4 cramps per week. And essentially what they found, was there was significant reduction. So the group that was having them daily reduced to only a couple times per week. And the group that had them, you know, weekly reduced to just once per month, and their intensity and everything else went down. So again, just from that 100 micrograms of K2. And then lastly, you know, when we look at cardiac output, this is important when it comes to exercise and endurance training. And this has to do with what's known as our VO2 max and our max heart rate. And we know that as we continue to increase that max heart rate, we actually get a decrease in speed and performance. And they've done lots of studies on marathon runners and people with intense exercise, that from around at the start of a race, 80% heart rate max to the start to 90% at finish, which correlated to a decrease in continued decrease in speed. And so ultimately, just to kind of summarize that a common problem in individuals with a high degree of aerobic training is they tend to experience that decreased maximum heart rate. And that, unfortunately, is going to have negative influences on their ability to maximize cardiac output and performance. And this is why intense exercise is actually very stressful for the body. And we see this being stressful also to the microbiome. And it's really because of this oxidative stress. So this was a study that we did with one of our K2 products, MyoMax, on cardiac output during exercise. And essentially what they found was they showed improvement in the mitochondria's ability to consume oxygen, which we want, right? Oxygen is necessary, again, to produce those high amounts of ATP. And if you think about intense training, we're actually depriving the body of oxygen. So we're really helping that aerobic cellular respiration. And this, what they found was with this supplementation of MyoMax, that this was actually equivalent to 6 months of intensive training, just essentially making our mitochondria more efficient. So one of the biggest questions, and this may be one of the questions we have from everyone listening, is what about, you know, safety and dosing of vitamin K2? Now, we don't have upper limits established. And that's why I pointed out that a lot of these studies use varying doses. And this is why, you know, there's not an RDI set, and it really sets the stage for, you know, having an understanding of this. So we see that upwards to 360 micrograms are required to achieve 90% of that activation of these vitamin K dependent proteins. But there has been one toxicity study that looked at vitamin K was non-toxic up to a dose of 20,000 milligrams. Now, I say milligrams because we dose in micrograms. So 20,000 milligrams is like 200, you know, or we typically do dosing between 200 and 300 micrograms. That's just 0.2 to 0.3 milligrams. Another question we get is about K2's impact on people who are on blood thinners like warfarin or Coumadin. And this was a rat model that showed that very, very high doses of vitamin K2 actually reduced the effects of warfarin, but the dose was at 145 milligrams per kilogram. That's like almost 10 million micrograms. So again, huge doses that we're seeing. So vitamin K2 is showing that it's just very, very safe. And then lastly, assessing vitamin K2. This is something we don't see in clinical practice from serum levels because there are some issues with, you know, drawing and technique and lab. So it's really reserved just for research. But this is where assessing and looking at the microbiome becomes necessary because we know that primary K2 production is through bacterial fermentation. And so I love doing, you know, stool tests. And this is where our biome effects test comes into play because we can look at the microbe's genetic capability or capacity to produce vitamin K2. So this is an example. If I don't see any K2, it's not a marker of sufficiency or deficiency. It's essentially showing that you're not making any endogenous production, so we need to support it exogenously or through supplementation. So we are committed to K2. We find K2 very exciting because we know we rely on our bacteria to produce this. But like we talked before, there's a lot of reasons why we have K2 deficiency. So we have three K2 products with varying doses, and some of them are meant to be combined or separate. But we do have a K2 D3. We are using a naturally fermented 100% soy-free K2. So our Megaquin D3 includes 5,000 IUs. We also have 160 micrograms of K2. Our Megaquinone includes a little bit of K2, 160 micrograms, but also a little bit of K1. So I wouldn't necessarily use this for someone who is on something like warfarin or Coumadin. And we also include some heart-healthy magnesium and zinc. And then MyoMax, that's what our study was done. This is our highest dose K2 with 300 micrograms, but we also include a little bit of pyruvate, which is necessary for mitochondrial support. So just to conclude, right, vitamin K2, it essentially is there to resuscitate the mitochondria, to improve mitochondrial efficiency, meaning using the oxygen more efficiently so that we can produce the max amount of ATP as possible, improving mitochondrial function and when it comes to that redox balance. And so this really plays a role in just about every health issue, as you can see here, from aging and cancers to cardiovascular disease, as well as neurodegenerative diseases. And there you have it.
Wow. I have my mic was muted, but I'm sitting here saying, wow to myself. Let's get some feedback for Kara. It's so good. And what was an aha moment for you all? Because for me, I didn't realize the powerhouse that was involved. Again, I underestimated it. I think that's really the terminology that best describes my experience of D3 and K2, and the role and potential it has to play in not just your mental health, because that's a big component, and your bone health, but also the mitochondrial health that we all could benefit from. So is anyone else like wowed by that? Just pop it into the chat if you are. I'd love to hear from you on that. We have a couple of questions, so let me get you those. Thank you so much. That was beautiful. Michelle, hi, Michelle. Hope you're doing well. Who knew more than energy, cardiac, bone, neuro, cancer? Yeah, exactly. I've read that there's a study, that there are studies showing that taking urolithin A is beneficial for mitochondria. Can you please tell us your viewpoint on taking urolithin A? What is urolithin A? I've not heard of it before.
So this comes from our polyphenols, and essentially urolithin is a byproduct. It's really a postbiotic that is where our microbes use polyphenols in the diet to create this postbiotic, and it has profound benefits actually on the mitochondria. We know its higher concentrations are linked to lower rates of neurodegenerative conditions, lower cancer, but interestingly enough, a lot of people can't convert dietary polyphenols to that urolithin A. So supplementation can be very, very helpful in supporting the mitochondria. But I also support really consuming it in the diet, lots of blueberries and cranberries and acai and all those beautiful colors that we see. So as much as we want to support it, it can be a very useful useful supplement. It can, we talked about that mitophagy, the removal of the dysfunctional, so it can help with that. It can stimulate the creation of new mitochondria. It can help reduce reactive oxygen species. So another good one. I didn't list them all.
Okay. And Anne is saying, hi, Anne. Are damaged mitochondrial in one area of the body affecting all mitochondria all over the body?
That's a great question. And, you know, I think it depends on how much reactive oxygen species are being created or how much that damage mitochondria in one area of the body is lending itself to increased oxidative stress. So that would be something interesting for me to look up, like because we have so much mitochondria in the body, like, you know, is this dysfunction that's happening everywhere? I would think that it could potentially, like a bucket, right? Like what else is going on that's contributing to development of chronic diseases, that, you know, the more mitochondrial dysfunction we have, what's damaging it is most likely damaging other mitochondria in the body too.
Yeah. It's all connected, right?
It's all connected.
Is it okay to take vitamin K2 independently of vitamin D and B12 because of too high levels in those vitamins?
So is it okay to take vitamin K2 independently?
From vitamin D. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, again, if you're already taking a vitamin D supplementation and you don't want more, yes, I would add in like the megaquinone or the MyoMax. Absolutely. But okay. I always support taking it together because then it's one less supplement that you need to take, right?
By the way, Karen Christian just texted me during the session. About something else. So, hey, Karen, shout out to all of the fans for Karen. Judith, is it okay? So that was that. And are there any other ways to improve mitochondrial health besides supplements? I'm just going to throw out there red light therapy.
Yep. You know, I think of mitochondria in the same light that I think of like detoxification too, right? So, you know, obviously improving sleep, but exercise. I didn't get into that, but there's been wonderful research articles looking at exercise and its ability to improve mitochondrial health. The diet, right? Like just right. cleaning up the diet, you know, removing some of these processed foods. So it's never one side. I always say whenever we talk about health, like supplements are great and we need them and they're necessary, but we also have to improve our sleep. We also have to improve our diet, our mental thoughts, right? The more stress
Meditate,
we have, the more meditation,
all those things. Ruth, hey, Ruth, good to have you here. What is the pyruvate in the MyoMax?
So that's a substrate that's created, right? We talked about that when we looked at cellular respiration, and that's created in the process of glycolysis, and that's needed to really enter into that Krebs cycle. So it's a mitochondrial support supplement.
Judith, I heard in a summit that hyperbaric oxygen therapy can be helpful for mitochondria. Yeah.
Well, I like that. I like that for lots of reasons too. Yeah.
I love that stuff. Brenda, I had to step away. What is the dosing when using the one with vitamin D versus the one without? And maybe you could restate which is which.
Yep. So MegaQuin D3 That's our vitamin K2 D3 supplement, and that has 5,000 IUs of D3, and it's got 160 micrograms of K2. So again, that's a nice one if we want to take it together. And then we have megaquinone, and that has, for one capsule, 160 micrograms of K2, but it also includes a little bit of K1, what we get from our leafy greens, so that's 100 micrograms of that. And then it includes a little bit of magnesium glycinate, just 36 milligrams, but enough to still be supportive, and a little bit of zinc bisglycinate, so 15 milligrams, which we know have a lot of wonderful benefits.
Okay, and if we take 5,000 D3 plus K2, MK7, 160 daily, will this discourage our gut bacteria from producing K2? Hi, Beth.
Not at all. And in fact, the K2 that our gut bacteria do produce, it's the most bioavailable form. And if you remember from that study where, you know, we could take quite a bit of K2. I mean, there were some studies actually looking at heart disease and osteoporosis of people going upwards to 500 micrograms of K2 per day. But the important thing with supplementations, it just eliminates that vitamin disparity. And so I think, you know, again, as we're always encouraging our bacteria, we're always encouraging, you know, supporting dysbiosis, this just helps so that if we're not producing, and then we don't have that way of measuring clinically serum wise, that we're making sure that we're getting enough of it. And again, those levels are varying. You know, I think that we can go fairly high, obviously.
Edward, hi, Edward. Does hydrogen help with mitochondrial health? You mean like the hydrogen water?
Oh, okay.
Doing? Yeah.
You know, I don't really have, I'm sure, I'm not really sure if there's been any studies done on it. I don't think it's hurting though. So I okay. always say what doesn't hurt us, you know, only makes us stronger, and we have in the power. I think hopefully what you can take away from this webinar today, aside from my technical difficulties and everything, is that we have a lot of things that we can do to support. So many things are out of our control, but right. we actually have a lot that's in our control, and it's pretty profound, and it's really empowering, right? I mean,
preach it. Preach it. That is what I think. SOS, yes. Save ourselves. Absolutely gorgeous. What a beautiful way to wrap up. Thank you so much for the fantastic presentation. I want to thank you all for coming. I haven't seen you in a little bit, it feels like, because I've been in this other family project, but it's good to be back. Yes, I'm in my bathroom. Let's see, for fun. Here we go. Let's see, stop video. Nope, that's not it. I was going to show you how pretty my bathtub was. Such a pretty bathtub. Anyway, so just to get like, you know, super real with you, but my cat is in here and there's a lot of work going on at the house and she was scared. So I thought, I'm going in there and hanging out with Petunia and hanging out with you. You did a beautiful job. Thank you so much. Thanks all for joining. Please look for the replay later on today. And we will be back with more phenomenal information as we proceed and wrap up this incredible year. And I hope you will take advantage of this wonderful 15% off. Use the codes and have at it. I'm going to be doing a question that I'm going to send out and looking for replies on. How do you all manage your supplement routines? I just created a supplement tracker for an upcoming summit that I'm doing, the Gut Rescue Summit. And I'm like, there've got to be other people out there who have a hard time managing their supplements. So I'm looking for suggestions. I'll send you an email about it though. Okay. You're a genius, woman. Okay.
Thank you.
Love you all. Thank you so much. Okay,
bye-bye.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Great job. Thanks, Clarissa. I'll see you in a minute. Bye.